From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And let's get right to those new jobs numbers. The Labor Department saying today that employers added just 38,000 new jobs in May, a shockingly low number to most economists who'd expected about 158,000 jobs. NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewack starts us off. And Marilyn, which industries suffered the most?
This is a tough time to be a blue-collar worker. We lost tens of thousands of jobs in mining and manufacturing last month. And, you know, in contrast, the places that were gaining jobs were the places with air conditioning. You know, it's offices, professional and business services, financial services, and certainly in healthcare. So that's where the jobs were growing.
Well, and this sort of parallels what we're hearing on the campaign trail, people in those industries that are losing the jobs. But how does this report compare with other recent months?
Well, you know, last year, the country was averaging about 220,000 new jobs each month. That was really good. We were all happy about that. But the pace has slowed a lot this year. Over the last 3 months, it's been averaging about half what it was a year ago. So that's all bad. And there's another negative in here. That's the dropout rate. A lot of people are just saying that I'm done. I'm out of the workforce. Now, to be fair, some of that, a good chunk of it maybe, is attributed to retiring baby boomers. There are tens of millions of baby boomers now in their 60s. They may just be fading away out of the workforce. But another big chunk could be discouraged workers. Say you're a 55-year-old coal miner who just lost their job. Maybe you don't want to be retired, but you're just out of the workforce now. So with all those people dropping out, the unemployment rate fell from 5% to 4.7%, but that's not the way we like to do it.
Well, but there's other things going on. Like there was a Verizon strike. Does that factor in?
Yeah, that is one kind of a fluke thing that was in there. In May, there were at least 35,000 Verizon workers who were on strike. That could have caused a sort of a spike in this number of idle workers. Strike settled now. They're expected to come back to work, so they should be out of there in June. But still, that's, you know, even if they were back in there, it would have been a low number. And there's another weird thing that might be happening here is there are a lot of employers who say they want to hire workers, but they can't find the people with the right skills in the right places. So this past week, for example, President Obama was in Elkhart, Indiana, talking about the low jobless rate there. It was about 4%. And a lot of employers were telling reporters there that they were constrained by the lack of available workers.
Right.
They wanted to hire, but they just can't find the people with the right skills.
That is another thing we're hearing from economists. Traditionally, people get up and move to where jobs are. They are not doing that this time.
Right.
So something,
low mobility.
Yeah, something we'll keep an eye on. NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewack, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, let's move to Europe today, where severe flooding continues after a week of heavy rain. France and Germany are seeing the worst of it. Jenny Hill is with the BBC and joins us from Berlin. And Jenny, describe what it's been like in the hardest hit areas of Germany today.
Yeah, the pictures coming out of some of these areas, particularly in Lower Bavaria, which is in the very south of Germany, are really very shocking indeed. We're talking about houses, towns seen from above still standing in water. People's homes are still filled with this water. Just a few days ago, even yesterday, what were roads had turned into raging torrents, rivers, if you like, just running down the streets. It's all very, very dramatic. These aren't the kind of scenes that you expect to see in a place like Germany. Nature has just taken over so many of these towns and villages.
Mm. Now, what's caused all of this flooding? Is it just the week of heavy rain that we've been seeing?
That's right, yes. People expected the weather to be bad this week, but I don't think they expected it to be quite as bad as this. A huge amount of rainfall has come in a very short space of time. One report said almost a half a month's worth of rain came down effectively in just a few minutes. That's overflowed creeks. The ground's already waterlogged, and that's led to these problems. We've had some unbelievably dramatic stories this week. People being winched from their homes by helicopter, standing on the roofs of their houses in order to stay above the floodwater. A school full of children, a class having to stay in a gym overnight because their school was surrounded by water. And then, of course, the death toll. 10 people have been killed so far in these floods since Sunday. In one case, reportedly, a woman, her mother and her grandmother all in one house when the water just came tumbling down through the street, engulfed the house, which then collapsed. Some terrible stories.
In France, we've been seeing entire towns being evacuated. Of course, there's all that news from Paris about, for example, artwork in the Louvre having to be moved up from the basement to higher ground. I mean, it sounds awful, you know, across much of Europe here. When are the waters expected to subside?
Forecasters have said that they've downgraded now the severe weather warnings, which we've lived with here now for the last few days. They are, though, saying that there are more storms, more rain on the way. It's just not expected to be quite so severe. Now, having said that, they are warning people not to be excessively optimistic. People in these areas are living without electricity, without running water. Many of them, of course, can't live in their homes at all. They've been evacuated. Those homes are still filled. So people are hoping that they've had a respite, that this is the end of it, certainly here in Germany. But there is still a huge amount of work to do. And that's before you even start thinking about the cleanup operation and the millions of euros, possibly hundreds of millions of euros, actually, it's going to take to rebuild some of these communities.
Jenny Hill with the BBC speaking to us from Berlin. Jenny, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And floods, of course, Magna, making news here at home. Emergency crews in central Texas still searching for four Fort Hood soldiers still missing after their truck overturned in a flooded creek during a training exercise at the Army base. At least five soldiers died when their truck overturned. More than half of Texas is under flood watches or warnings. And all of this rain is sparking fears about Zika. Ashley Lopez from Here and Now contributor KUT in Austin explains.
Texas is at high risk for transmission of Zika this mosquito season. There's no getting around that. We have lots of the creatures that transmit it, the Aedes aegypti mosquito. And of course, there are people here in Texas who are going to travel to a country with Zika. The biggest worry right now is what this means for women who are pregnant or could get pregnant in the coming months.
Zika virus is really most concerning in the pregnant population. In the non-pregnant population, it's not, at this point, perceived to be a large risk.
That's Dr. Ted Held. He's the director of reproductive health at the People's Community Clinic here in Austin. He explains the Zika virus is known to cause some serious birth defects, some fatal. So that's what he's worried about. Held says on the bright side, state health officials have been making plans.
So I do feel like the state's done a great job at being prepared. That being said, you can only be so prepared. None of us, I think, have any certainty about how large the epidemic will or won't be.
All we have right now are estimates of what the scale of this problem could be. Researchers at the left-leaning Center for American Progress ran some numbers. They estimated in all the states with the Aedes aegypti mosquito, a total of 2 million women will likely be pregnant during mosquito season. In Texas alone, they estimated almost 500,000 women. And reproductive health advocates say this could put the state's healthcare infrastructure to the test.
This current public health crisis really highlights a longstanding neglect of women's health and autonomy.
Kinsey Hasted works with the Guttmacher Institute, which studies issues related to reproductive health care. She says in countries battling Zika, like Brazil, the virus has exposed some realities about the state of those services. Hasted says if Zika gets into the state's mosquito population, there may be similar issues here.
Texas has a lot of pretty negative indicators for sexual and reproductive health. Of course, it has the highest proportion of uninsured women of reproductive age of any state in the country. It also is in the top 10 of states with the highest unintended pregnancy rate in the country.
Dr. Ted Held is concerned about this, too. He explains when it comes to access to health care in Texas, there's a big difference for women who are currently pregnant and women who aren't but could get pregnant. Held says this is where family planning becomes really important.
Half of all pregnancies that are conceived in Texas are unintended. So in the face of Zika virus infection, that's a little bit of a concern if it becomes a more epidemic-type infection.
And family planning for low-income women, especially women without health insurance, has a checkered past here in Texas. State lawmakers slashed funding and restructured its family planning program a couple of years ago. It made getting things like contraception much harder for some women. The state recently started fixing that problem, but lawmakers also made access to abortion more difficult. Kinsey Hasted with the Guttmacher Institute says the state also missed an opportunity to make sure low-income women of reproductive age have health insurance when it refused to expand Medicaid in the state. All in all, she says the state may have set itself up for some of the same problems other countries are facing.
It certainly raises a concern, and the potential for Zika hitting these parts of the country, including Texas, raises a flag and has brought a lot of these issues to the fore. But it is unfortunate that it just is another highlight of longstanding neglect for these policies that could have really advanced women's access to coverage and care.
At the People's Community Clinic, Dr. Held has tested about a dozen at-risk pregnant women so far. He says thankfully none have tested positive for the virus.
I think we have good protocols in place, but I think only time will tell whether the resources are going to be there to meet the challenge, because we don't know what the challenge is going to be.
So far, the state of Texas has reported one confirmed case of Zika in a pregnant woman to the CDC. According to the state health department, there have been 12 additional pregnancies in Texas with laboratory evidence of Zika infection. But further testing has come back inconclusive. For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Matthew Quick's debut novel turned film, Silver Linings Playbook, was about a young man with bipolar disorder. Matthew's new book has characters wrestling with possibly budding mental health issues, but it's hard to tell because they're teens. Are they inflamed with passions or about to crash? And is the student who seems to be flaming out actually saving herself? Matthew knows this group well. He's a former teacher. Every Exquisite Thing is his fourth YA novel, sort of a catcher in the rye in praise of nonconformity. But only to a point. It also features a fictional author and a fictional book, one that, like Catcher, speaks to teens, but in ways the author never intended. And by the way, some of the topics the teens explore may come up in our conversation, mental health and sexuality, as Matthew Quick joins us from the studios of WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so how much is this about Catcher in the Rye?
I taught Catcher in the Rye for 7 years when I was a high school English teacher, and I love Salinger, and, you know, subconsciously I'm sure he's influencing me. But really, the story came out of publishing a book of mine called Forgive Me, Leonard Peacock, which is in a pretty intense book about a young man who takes a gun to school, intent on killing his best friend and then himself. And it's definitely a story about mental health. It's a story about schools, and many teenagers wrote to me and poured their hearts out. I got letters saying, you know, this book saved my life, but I need to know what happens to Leonard next, and I need to know what this means in the book. And it was very overwhelming, and I started to wonder about the author's responsibility, especially when writing back to kids that were sometimes 14, 15, 16 years old. How much did I owe them?
So are you, in fact, Nigel Booker, the author of the Bubblegum Reaper book, which these kids in your new book are obsessed with, and who pulls his book when it becomes fabulously successful because he's so nervous about that responsibility to his young readers? Is that you?
No, there are many differences between myself and Nigel. I don't welcome fans into my home, and I put up pretty strong boundaries, primarily for mental health reasons, often kind of bewildered about how do I protect my own mental health, how do I protect my own personal boundaries, but also acknowledge them as human beings. And what I see is that there's so many people out there that are hurting and their needs are not being met, and I hope that literature is a way to get the job done to a point. Booker was kind of a way for me to explore the concept, if you will.
Well, and there's stories within stories within stories, because Booker, your fictional author, who may have whiffs of, you know, some of the experience you've had, he writes his book, The Bubblegum Reaper, based on some of his own personal experiences when he was young. These kids that become obsessed with him and his book become sleuths, you know, about his life and how the book came to be. He introduces Nanette, who's a high schooler who's straight-jacketed by the expectations of her parents and her school that she be a star soccer player, that she toe the line and go to college. And he introduces her to Alex, who's one of his fans. Alex, we soon figure out, seems to be a little bit unhinging. The Silver Linings Playbook was about mental health. How do you come to that issue?
Very personally, actually. I'm somebody who has dealt with depression and anxiety for my entire life, but I never talked about it until I wrote the Silver Linings Playbook. Mm-hmm. And I kind of tricked myself into writing this book that I thought was about football and father-son relationships. But surprise, you know, subconsciously I was writing a book about mental health. And my way of dealing with depression, anxiety in high school was repression. Much like Nanette, like I tried to be this perfect kid. I didn't talk about my feelings. I pushed them down. I did what I was supposed to do. And even when, into my adult years when I was teaching high school English, I became this kind of character. You know, my students used to call me Q, and it felt very much like every time I walked into the school, which is very much a school like Nanette attends, I put on this mask and I try to toe the party line. And, you know, I would tell kids, like, it's really important to get a high SAT score, like, even though I didn't believe that that was true. And I got very sick from doing that. It was something that I did to get tenure, to fit into a community. And as a writer, I discovered I was finally able to tell the truth in my books in the way that I wasn't allowed to do in my personal life. And that was really freeing. And so, you know, Nanette gets this message. She kind of figures it out at 18. You know, she figures out this secret that I didn't figure out until I was 30, which was you don't have to do what everybody wants you to do.
But the pull on kids today is you know, to be that kid who writes the perfect essay, who does the perfect community service, who, you know, has the, you know, is the perfect athlete so that schools, I mean, actually, did you ever come across kids who, as happens with your character Nanette, her father, who's an investor of some kind, invested in her personal portfolio something like $100 every time she made a goal?
That was fiction. There was nobody I met, but I could definitely see that happening in the school where I taught.
Well, we understand Nanette. Alex is a little harder to understand what you're trying to say here, because he also seems to have his heart in the right place. He was a kid who was bullied, but then when he gets older, he realizes that his strength can protect him, and he becomes what he thinks is the protector of kids who are getting bullied. But he gets in trouble for going too far. His anger goes too far. He's writing poetry about overthrowing some of these expectations. But then it's you start to think, well, wait a second, is this a kid we're cheering for or we're worried about?
I wanted there to be polar opposites for Nanette. You know, on the one hand, she has, you know, this society that tells her if you're a good girl, you go to college and, you know, you'll become, you know, the American woman that everyone's supposed to be. And on the other hand, you have Alex, who's this kid that's almost like an anarchist. You know, he wants to take matters into his own hands. He's going to solve his problems with violence. He
doesn't want to cause.
Yeah. I mean, whatever it takes, he's going to do. And it's very seductive, especially for a young person to think like that. But of course, there are great consequences. And I guess what I want the reader to think about is there some middle ground there? You know, is there something in between, like going all in with your town, or, you know, completely rebelling? Like, can we find some middle ground that's healthy?
Mm. You mentioned your reader. These are young readers, right? What's the age you're thinking?
I don't really think about, you know, the age of my I just try to tell a good story. And to be honest, many adults read these books, too. But yeah. I'm sure that my publisher would probably say late 10th grade through 12th grade is
okay.
The target market.
Well, so I'm thinking, really? The amount of sex that these kids have, the amount of discussion on the part of the girls, Nanette's friends okay, alert here now to parents who might be listening. Let's just give a couple seconds if someone feels they need to turn the dial. But oral sex, the amount of discussions by the girls, for instance, of male body parts, the boys who use the girls, really? It just seems like a lot.
Well, I think if you want to tell the truth, you have to tell the truth. I remember very clearly when I was teaching, there was a first-year teacher that was teaching next to me. In the middle of one of my lessons, she knocked on the door, and she was very upset. And I went outside in the hallway and I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "I'm reading through these essays and all of these kids are having sex and they're writing about it in the most graphic ways." And I said, "Well, they must really trust you because they're telling the truth." When I've talked with young people, they have one face that they'll put on for the people who don't want to hear about those things. And they're very good at it. And I don't think the book glorifies sex in any way.
No.
In fact, I think it shows, you know, that there are really, you know, dark consequences to kids having sex before thinking it out. You know, I don't think it vilifies sex either. And I think people, you know, especially in suburbia, could do well to have more frank conversations about sex.
Yeah. Matthew Quick, you talk about some of the parallels with your own life. You were an English teacher. You've got this fictional author who's not you, but still I'm wondering if through him, you're also trying to do something else with this book for young people. He keeps sending the kids off on other literary journeys. You know, read Bukowski, Antigone, Dorian Gray, or even the music of Pat Benatar, you know, makes its way in.
Yeah, I mean, I think the poetry and, you know, literature and music for me was always, as a teen and as an adult, it was a place where I could go to get some answers, to get some truth, you know, to have dialogue in a way that was not possible with the people in my real life.
Well, and here's another passage. You have your character, Booker, the teacher, say, Pablo Neruda said it better than I can. Tonight I can write. Read that poem if you haven't already. You'll fall in love with Neruda and wish you were 18 when he was, that you knew him in Chile a long time ago. I'm betting that your hope is that just like when kids are on a website, they'll click on through somewhere and look for that and read that.
Pablo Neruda is a fantastic poet. You know, I hope they read tons of things, you know, not just what's in my book. I hope they read my book. I hope they read lots of books. You know, Kurt Vonnegut's one of my heroes, and I've heard him described as a gateway drug for reading. I think that many of the authors that I mentioned throughout the book, if those things hook kids and get them reading, or if my book hooks them and gets them reading and asking questions, like, that's beautiful. I just hope that they'll continue.
That's Matthew Quick. His new book is Every Exquisite Thing. It comes out this week. Matthew, thank you so much.
Hey, it was an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. And here's some more of that Neruda poem. Tonight I can write the saddest lines. I no longer love her, that's certain, but how I loved her. My voice tried to find the wind to touch her hearing. I no longer love her, that's certain, but maybe I love her. Love is so short. Forgetting is so long. Ah, great for teens and a great book. So two high schoolers, Kevin Nguyen and TJ Cayetan, 16 and 17, recently took a trip to the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Very cool. But the reaction was, really? This is art? Then Kevin took off his eyeglasses, put them on the ground, and, well, they posted pictures on social media. We'll post them at hereandnow.org of museum goers crowding around what they thought was a new exhibit. Kevin, what led you to that? What were you seeing?
We saw this one that had basically a gray blanket and two stuffed animals on top of it. And we were just dumbfounded. We didn't know what to say. It's crazy how people can even see that as art.
Well, you're not the first to think that. But then you decide what? That maybe my glasses can be art? What do you think?
I took off my jacket and I looked at TJ. I was like, TJ, you know, I'm just going to put this down and see what happens. Only one person really looked at it, but we just kept poking at it. And that last try where my glasses were on the floor and everyone started taking pictures, that was the try it worked. And we were cracking up.
So people were what? What were they saying about the glasses? How modern?
It was more of like a quiet interpretation. So they were just thinking to themselves, looking at it, their chin on their hand. There's this one guy with a high-quality camera that he bent down to get angles, which is really funny. So,
well,
yeah.
You know, you're onto something, because at one time, Italian artist Federico Moro did an entire exhibit of eyeglasses. These were beautiful pictures, very stark, blank background, and then there would be the folded eyeglasses of Elton John or John Lennon or Malcolm X, and all it had underneath the eyeglasses was their name. I mean, the guy made a lot of money. So I guess the modern art lover would say to you, you know, there is beauty in your eyeglasses, and there is beauty with a blanket and two teddy bears on it. Have you thought of that?
I mean, when people ask me how would I interpret it as if I actually meant for it to be an art piece, you know, I said that, you know, everything can be art, but as long as you provide the insight and help people see what you see.
You'd like a little guidance.
Yeah.
Well, and that's exactly the opposite of what artists do, right? They put it out there and whatever you think.
Yeah.
Well, were people angry that they had been, in a way, pranked?
I mean, of course they're going to be angry, but there was a lot of good feedback and a lot of people that thought it was really funny, actually.
And so what happened when you picked the glasses up?
Oh, that was a really awkward interaction. So I waited for the crowd to clear out, and I walked back to my glasses, put it on, and I put my head down and just walked away really fast. But there's this couple next to me. that was laughing because he knew what was going on.
So. Didn't any security guard stop you and say, wait, you're taking the artwork?
No, thankfully, because I wouldn't know how to explain it to them.
Yeah. By the way, I mean, have you thought more about your eyeglasses, that eyeglasses are the windows on the world for people, that they are shaped differently for different people to express personality? Have you thought about them? No.
Yeah.
Oh, you have. Okay.
Yeah. It's just how glasses provide the insight. Like I said, you know, anything can be art, but if you provide the insight, like glasses provide your vision, then yeah. I don't know if that makes sense.
It doesn't have to. We're talking about modern art. Well, congratulations. Kevin Nguyen, one of two boys who recently made an impromptu art exhibit at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lots going on recently in Europe's migrant crisis. Tensions are high in the main detention camp for migrants and refugees on the Greek island of Lesbos. Hundreds of people were evacuated from the camp this week after a brawl broke out and nearly 30 tents were set ablaze. And in just the past 2 weeks, aid officials say more than 1,000 migrants may have been lost at sea while attempting to cross the Mediterranean from Libya. So that's the backdrop to the recent news that the EU is planning to strike a deal with Libya's new government. The EU would provide monetary aid in exchange for greater efforts from Libya in reducing the flow of migrants and refugees across the sea. Dimitrios Papadimitriou heads the Brussels-based research group Migration Policy Institute Europe, and he joins us now. Welcome.
It is my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So first of all, could you just describe to us what kind of deal is the European Union seeking to work out with Libya?
Well, first of all, they want to have a stable government in Libya, at least as stable as it can be made, and then have a deal that would be somewhat similar to the deal that they had with Turkey. That means that they want the full cooperation of the Libyan government to attack the smugglers, and by that I mean it in the full sense of the word. Have their ships confiscated or sunk or whatever it is, hit them where it matters most in the pocketbook, and try to understand how they operate. This way they can actually intervene earlier in the process. They also want the Libyans to push back boats that are still in Libyan waters back to Libya. In other words, to as much as possible prevent large numbers of people leaving Libya on their way to Europe, in this case, primarily on their way to Italy. And these are the two things that they want more than anything else, because the Europeans understand, and in the last 2 weeks ago, the point has been driven home, that they must reduce not only the numbers who are trying to make it to Europe, but they must reduce the numbers of people who are dying in the central Mediterranean.
Right. Now, if I understand correctly, in the past, Italy, if not the entire EU, but Italy specifically had something of a similar deal with then-Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Is that right?
That is correct. Mr. Berlusconi, who was the prime minister of Italy at the time, had cut a deal. Those deals are never neat from Mr. Berlusconi's perspective. This was an opportunity for him to put a lot of money on the table in order to dramatically reduce the numbers of people who were making it to Italy. And for a 2 or 3 year period, indeed, we had very few people coming across.
I am seeing here, though, that at the time, there were critics of the deal who basically called it, what, payola to Gaddafi to take care of a problem that Europe was having difficulty managing.
And that's, you know, there's an element of truth in that. The humanitarians and advocates have attacked all of these deals. And they simply feel that Europe should simply do the right thing as far as they are concerned, which is simply find a way to take in all of the people that want to go to Europe without much regard to who these people are or whether they qualify for full refugee status or, for that matter, people who want to migrate in order to better their lives. And that's not how life works. So in the process of the Europeans trying to reduce the numbers and the number in which people come into Europe, they cut some deals that, you know, are a bit, I guess most of us will sort of turn our nose at. And you hope that a message will be sent both to smugglers, with the cooperation, of course, of the sending or transit countries like Libya, and to would-be migrants themselves, which is a message that says, don't try it this way.
Mm-hmm. Do you have concern that these deals could put the migrants' own right to try to migrate at risk? I mean, I'm thinking of the fact that Ben Rollins wrote in the New York Times a recent op-ed where, you know, saying that the world is moving toward a situation in which the rights of the refugees are enumerated not in international laws and treaties, but in dollars and euros. That, you know, I suppose a very cynical way of looking at it is that Europe might be paying countries like Libya to lock up people who are seeking refuge.
What we have to consider here is the two, in a sense, difficult sides that European nations, forget Brussels for a second, Italy, let's say, or Germany, how they have to square the circle. One of them is a fundamental responsibility that they have to try to legislate or act on behalf of all of their people. That is the function of government. And on the other hand, you have both international law, but also rules and practice that, in a sense, interfere with this. So the sweet spot, as far as we should be concerned, you know, people who are analysts and, you know, are trying to figure these things out, is somewhere whereby those people who are real refugees, by that I mean bona fide refugees, they meet the definition of what a refugee is according to international instruments, that they are protected. And those people who may need protection, I suspect that we give them some temporary protection. But those people who are the people that we would call in the United States unauthorized migrants, people who may be very nice like you and I, but at the same time do not have a claim to protection, those people need to be sent back.
And of course, one of the follow-on questions from that is sent back to where and to what conditions?
And this is, you know, the billion-dollar question, because you can send them back to where they disembarked from, but are these fundamentally places that will offer a modicum of protection? Mm-hmm. Then you're going to have to also find a way to send these people back to where they came from. And as long as they didn't come from circumstances in which their life, because of all the reasons that we know, being membership in a social group, you know, outright war, etc., their life is not threatened, their existence is not being denied, then that's what we'll need to find a way to do. It's going to take a long time to do so. It's going to take real money. The latest figures, I was in Brussels all of last week, the latest figures are 60 billion, that's 60 billion euro over the next several years, in order to basically begin to attack some of the causes, not the root causes. You're not going to fix every country in Africa, but trying to test different ideas in terms of development aid, humanitarian aid, good governance, education, training, etc., that will keep most of the people in those countries.
And finally, Demetrios, we've been talking about Libya and Turkey in terms of deals that the EU is working on or either has struck with some of these countries where the migrants are coming from. But we should point out that the EU is also working with or has similar deals with Ethiopia, Kenya, Nigeria, Niger. So a lot of countries over quite a long period of time. Do we know how effective this strategy has been?
Well, we've had nothing but lack of success. You know, failure is what defines all this. The European Union, at the level of the relevant commissioner, meaning a minister for the EU, the European Union has been trying these negotiations for about 13, 14, 15 years now. But what they've been putting on the table is just a couple of euro, 3, 5, 7 million, that kind of thing.
So you think the billions could make a difference?
The billions could make a difference, and the sense that this time the EU is serious about these matters. And if you can convey this, you can certainly have a slightly and sometimes a dramatically different conversation with these members, with these states, than the one that you've had in the past.
And so how does the EU convey that seriousness beyond the billions of euro?
By sending people back, I'm afraid. Making certain that while you rescue people, you don't at the same time guarantee that you're going to bring them to Europe and as a result accomplish their aim and the aim of the smugglers. Mm. The only way that you do this is by being able to send people back.
Well, Dimitrios Papadimitriou heads the Brussels-based research group, the Migration Policy Institute Europe. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you.
You may remember our visit last year with Gloucester, Massachusetts Police Chief Leonard Campanello. A year ago this week, he announced that his officers would start helping opioid addicts into treatment rather than arresting them.
From the beginning, we were very aware of what we were undertaking and had hoped on the cavalry coming, so to speak, and it seems to be happening.
But since then, in fact, more than 400 people have turned themselves into the Gloucester Police Station. More than 100 police departments across the country have started similar programs, and Campanello was recognized at the White House. Deborah Becker from Here and Now contributor WBUR has this look back at the first year of the so-called Angel Program.
A year ago, 31-year-old Steve Lesnikowski flew to Massachusetts from his native California and became the first participant in the Gloucester program.
You know, I was the first person in the United States to walk into a police station, admit that I'm a heroin addict, and literally it was like, please help me.
Police assigned a volunteer or angel to work with Lesnikowski. He went to a 4-day detox program, and then, because of insurance, Lesnikowski went back to California for longer treatment.
I ended up getting high that night that I left treatment, so I was back in the same position, and I had no idea how I got there.
Lesnikowski was living in a car and says he was suicidal. After a few weeks, he decided to listen to his phone messages. One was from Gloucester, Massachusetts Police Chief Leonard Campanello, who started the Angel Program. The chief was checking in on Lesnikowski since he left Massachusetts.
And I heard the message that he left me, and he said, you know, I don't care where you are, what you're doing. I just want to know that you're okay. And I ended up calling him back. And, I broke down crying on the phone. And I told him what was going on and that, you know, I was in the same position again and that I needed help. And then he offered a treatment bed out here. And I've been here since August 7th of last year.
Chief Campanello started the Angel Program after repeatedly witnessing the ravages of the opioid epidemic, skyrocketing overdose deaths, increasing drug-related crimes, and officers often arresting the same people over and over again. So Campanello felt that police had to do something different.
We're an entity that, right, wrong, or different, has a very loud voice in this right now that people seem to be paying attention to. Our job is to lend that voice to people who are suffering from this disease and their support groups.
Also, Campanello says statistics show the program's working. In the first 5 months of 2015, he says there were 5 fatal drug overdoses in Gloucester. In the first 5 months of this year, there's been 1. The chief also says since the program started, there's been a 27% reduction in drug-related crimes.
The crimes of desperation, shoplifting, larceny, smash and grabs have declined since the beginning of the program.
Those aren't the only statistics. Boston University School of Public Health researchers are following up with program participants. So far, they've reached about 200 of the more than 400 people who've gone to Gloucester Police for help over the past year. The early numbers suggest almost 70% of the participants completed a treatment program, but 40% of the 100 people who would answer the question say they did use drugs after first contacting police. BU Public Health Professor David Rosenblum says those numbers are still an improvement.
People who receive the kind of help that they've received by going into a police station, of all places, where people have treated them with respect and dignity, we think that people going through a program like that with continuing support are more likely to be successful in entering recovery than people who don't get this kind of help.
Rosenblum says the program has saved lives, shed light on weaknesses in the treatment system, and changed the conversation about law enforcement's role in the opioid epidemic. But Jonathan Blodgett, the chief prosecutor for Gloucester, remains skeptical about the ANGEL program. He maintains that police don't have the legal authority to promise amnesty to those possessing illegal drugs. And he wants to see hard data about the program, including outcomes. But Campanello says with opioid addiction, not much is certain, and police should try to help.
The only guarantee we've ever made is that we'll be here for the rest of the person's life who becomes a participant, even if it's in relapse, will continue to be here.
And Steve Lesnikowski, the first ANGEL program participant, says Chief Campanello's continuing involvement over the past year was crucial to his ability to put an end to his 13-year opioid habit, a habit that began when he was prescribed painkillers for a high school sports injury. Now, Lesnikowski lives in East Boston with roommates and is planning to return to school to finish his degree this fall.
This life that's kind of come together is beyond anything I ever dreamed. It's amazing. I think back to where I was this time last year. I can't describe the amount of gratitude that I have.
And he plans to show that gratitude by working in the recovery community, maybe even working with police, to assist others struggling with opioid use. For Here and Now, I'm Deborah Becker.
And we'll link you to Deborah's and our original reporting on this story at hereandnow.org. Quite something. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jeremy is back on Monday, broadcasting from California before that state's primary. This is Here and Now.